every human being has a thirst for freedom, and the Chinese people do too.
Widespread protests in China against the communist government's rigid COVID restrictions. Reaction from a religious liberty perspective as the Vatican calls out China for violating an agreement about Catholic bishops there.
You just don't know what each day will bring. We have issues with water. We have issues with electricity.
The challenges of running the only neonatal unit in Palestine, just steps from the Church of the Nativity in Bethlehem. We take you there as the hospital approaches a big milestone.
You can see the spirituality coming out through the art, whether it's Egypt or Greece or Rome.
My discussion with a Catholic author who leads a pilgrimage to see God inside a museum.
The problem is we've looked to our public schools as the exemplar for how we ought to be as Catholic schools.
And one man's faith journey takes him straight down a path to opening a new Catholic school. EWTN News In Depth starts now.
Protests erupt across China. Thousands take to the streets in more than a dozen cities in a rare show of defiance against the Chinese Communist Party, or the CCP. Welcome to EWTN News In Depth. Chinese police quickly deployed forces to crack down on demonstrations sparked in populous cities, on university campuses, and remote regions. They also tightened online censorship in an effort to block videos of the protests. And alarming video of violent protests at the world's largest iPhone factory located in central China. Footage shows police in white hazmat suits beating workers with batons and metal rods. Protesters tore down the COVID barriers and hurled them at police. The workers are outraged over unfair treatment, a change in their contracts that impacted their salaries, and COVID-related concerns about their living conditions in on-site dormitories. These demonstrations are just the latest in a series of growing concerns in China, including limits on freedom of speech and religious liberty restrictions that have drawn condemnation from world leaders, including Pope Francis. Shouts for freedom. For democracy. For the president of China, Xi Jinping, to step down. A deadly apartment fire that killed at least 10 people triggered the protests. The deaths are blamed on metal barriers used in stringent COVID lockdown measures, which delayed firefighters from getting close to the blaze.
I'm overwhelmed. Every conscientious Chinese should be here. They don't have to voice their opinions, but I hope they can stand with us.
These demonstrations are unprecedented in a country where criticism of the regime can lead to prison or worse. Scholars and human rights activists have been following these demonstrations closely.
My source is in China. It's a protest against the Communist Party because the people understand that the Communist Party is using COVID as an excuse to impose more restrictions on their freedom.
It signals the beginning of the end of the Chinese Communist Party and the fall of President Xi himself.
The protests broke out the same weekend the Vatican issued a statement condemning the Chinese authorities for violating the terms of a provisional agreement. The agreement, the details of which have never been made fully public, was originally signed in 2018, extended in 2020, and again extended just weeks ago for another 2 years. The controversial agreement allows the regime to appoint bishops and then have Rome approve them.
It's been a disaster. It's affected the Vatican's moral credibility.
It's hard to see why the Vatican would strike any kind of deal with such a diabolical anti-religious freedom regime.
The Vatican says Chinese authorities violated the terms in the agreement by installing an auxiliary bishop of a diocese that is not recognized by the Vatican.
China is not interested in accommodating the Catholic Church. It's interested in bringing it under its control.
In an interview with America Magazine, Pope Francis said the agreement has had failures and successes, but that he cannot find another way to carry out diplomacy with the communist regime. The Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman is pleading ignorance to the Vatican outcry.
The controversial Vatican-China agreement has been highly criticized by Catholics both inside and outside of China. Cardinal Joseph Zen, who has become the face of the Catholic Church in Hong Kong, has openly condemned the deal and has been an outspoken critic of China's Communist Party. Just last week, the 90-year-old was found guilty for his association with protests back in 2019. At the time, the massive demonstrations in Hong Kong drew international attention and support. This past May, officials put Zen under house arrest. He was found guilty last week for failing to register a now-defunct fund that provided aid for protesters. He must now pay a several hundred-dollar fine. The government of China only officially recognizes five religions, including Catholicism, Protestantism, Buddhism, Taoism, and Islam. But all religions there faced a grim reality of censorship, surveillance, and oversight. Uyghur Muslims are one of the most well-known persecuted religious minorities. The U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom says more than 900,000 Uyghurs are being held in forced slave labor camps, enduring dreadful conditions, isolation, and often torture. Also detained behind bars, media tycoon Jimmy Lai. In a bold move, he's pleading not guilty to charges of foreign collusion and sedition in an effort to draw attention to the collapse of democracy in Hong Kong. His former colleagues are pleading guilty in hopes of a reduced sentence. Lai is the founder of media company Next Digital and owner of the pro-democracy newspaper Apple Daily, which China shut down last year. He's a devout Catholic who has been jailed for nearly 2 years after being convicted for civil disobedience and fraud. On Thursday, the court postponed his trial due to a dispute over whether Lai can hire a British lawyer.
The government is arguing that having a British lawyer in this case threatens national security. The important thing is that it shows that increasingly in Hong Kong, under Chinese control, guilt or innocence, the reality of guilt or innocence doesn't matter. You know, you either adhere to the party line or you're an enemy of the state. Jimmy knows that, but he's putting it all out in the open for the world to see.
Lai's trial has been postponed until December 13th. We will be following this story and update you as details become available. Paul Marshall is an expert on Asian affairs. He's a senior fellow at the Religious Freedom Institute and at the Hudson Institute and joins us now with analysis of these developments. Paul, it's great to have you with us. It's impossible to look at these images and not be outraged. Where is the public outcry from the international community?
Very little, and also, except in one instance, also very little outcry from the church. The Vatican, except in the case of a recent appointment of a bishop, which violated an agreement, the Vatican has also been sadly silent on many of these things.
Paul, as the director of RFI's South and Southeast Asia Action Team, you must have your ear to the ground. Is there something unique about these protests? Can we glean something or expect something different to come from them?
What is unique about the protests is that there are, in fact, protests. China is so clamped down. It has this social credit system of monitors everything you do, whether or not you can take a train, whether or not you can fly a plane. So with the system of control, demonstration, opposition to the government has been almost impossible. So the fact that it's taken place is itself significant. I don't think it has the ability to make major changes in China at the moment, but the government does seem to have backed off. The protests were immediately against the lockdowns because of COVID, and the government seems to be retreating on that front and opening things up. So this sort of pressure has had a local effect, which is very good.
Well, we'll be looking forward to tracking how that develops. There are a lot of headlines about phone supply shortages after the Foxconn factory protests, but really none that delve into the horrible working conditions and the COVID lockdowns they've dealt with. Where is the accountability there?
I would look to Apple particularly in these cases, since its major factory was involved. But our corporations, American corporations, which are operating in China, make these agreements to go along with Chinese government policies. They will not upset it. And I think there's got to be pressure on these corporations that they cannot sell away freedoms which would apply in the United States. This is even true with corporations here. With Hollywood, will change movies rather than upset China. The National Basketball Association will restrict any criticism of China. Otherwise, China will ban its TV programs. So we need to, one lever we do have is corporations, sports leagues in the United States to develop some sort of a backbone in dealing with China.
So really asking for leadership from them. Let's talk about Jimmy Lai. He has this bold move to plead innocent and bring in a British lawyer. That has not gone unnoticed. What can we expect from his evolving situation?
I think the government will... what the Chinese government is seeking to do is, obviously, it's repressing everybody, and the policies it follows in the mainland, it's now applying in Hong Kong. But in the main, it's trying to do it slowly. You know, it's avoiding sort of shooting people or sending them off to labor camps for life, but slowly increasing restrictions, as with Cardinal Zed. He was convicted only of a very minor offense and had a fine for that. But that's a warning. He's being investigated for national security. So it's being said to Zen now, shut up or something worse will happen. And similarly with Jimmy Lai, I think they'll try something soft at first. If he doesn't shut up, then they will keep pushing till he's spending years in prison. They're simply not brooking any resistance or any freedom.
Pope Francis has mentioned and showed some frustration with this being all that he can do with the Chinese regime. Does the Vatican have any real sway with the Chinese government?
I don't think it has very much sway. You know, with the Chinese government, you know, it's taken over the South China Sea. It violated its agreement to take over Hong Kong. And I think the response of the Chinese Communist Party is, well, what are you going to do about it? You can't do anything about it. And I fear that's the same attitude in dealing with the Vatican in terms of the agreement on the joint appointment of bishops, which they now appear to have violated, and the Vatican has spoken out. But China's own response to that is, well, we should have friendly conversations. So in that sense, it was a gentle response. But I'm not sure the Vatican has many means to pressure China, and it should seek as much as possible to preserve the independence of the Catholic Church in China.
And there's nothing that they could actually do? There's no real firepower they could bring to bear aside from calling them out publicly?
Calling them out publicly, raising this issue in international fora, along with the question of Hong Kong and other things, and then calling on the Catholic bishops in China, who have been appointed by the Vatican, to seek to maintain their independence and to, as much as they can, resist the controls which the government is trying to impose on. You know, you can't involve anybody under the age of 18 in any religious work and so on. I think a quiet campaign to maintain their independence for the Vatican to support its bishops and its clergy in China is probably the best we can do at the moment. but there aren't any heavy levers that we have.
That's disappointing, but we'll keep praying for the Chinese people. Thank you so much, yes. Paul.
And we can. Thank you very much.
Cardinal Robert Seurat of Guinea warns that religious liberty is also threatened in the West. In a recent interview with EWTN, he suggested Christians face more subtle forms of bias. He also criticized the lockdowns during the pandemic, which impacted in-person worship.
Through the pandemic, draconian restriction on the mass were widely accepted without objection. Certainly, it is good to protect human life, but not to consider what was given up. That is hardly to live at all. Many have died during the pandemic without sacrament. Religious liberty is not to be taken for granted or compromised or neglected.
Just within the United States, EWTN News In Depth has covered multiple religious liberty cases, including a Supreme Court injunction on the state of California for its strict rules banning indoor worship services during the pandemic, and Kennedy versus Bremerton School, in which the majority of justices said a school district violated the rights of a football coach for praying with students on the field. We're also watching threats to religious liberty on Capitol Hill. Coming up later, more on controversial legislation on marriage that may impact Christians in the U.S. EWTN News will be right back.
We are with the woman in her pain, then in her joy. We see the first moment of life.
And next, Christians and Muslims working hand in hand in the only neonatal unit in Bethlehem. They help bring new life into the world within yards of the birthplace of Jesus.
I would never go back to any other model of education than the classical model, having seen it and experienced it with my own kids.
And what prompted a former atheist to create a new Catholic school described as the future of Catholic education? We have the answer a little later on EWTN News In Depth.
Always we have joy here, new babies, a new life.
As we enter the Advent season, a look inside the only neonatal hospital in Palestine, a lifeline in Bethlehem for newborn babies. In about a month's time, Holy Family Hospital is expecting to deliver its 100,000th baby. The hospital is run by the Order of Malta. It's famous throughout Palestine for the care it provides. In the lead up to Christmas, the significance of the hospital is even more special because of its location. Here's reporter Colin Flynn.
If you want to see how precious life is, you just have to peer into one of these incubators in this neonatal hospital ward. For it's within the walls of the Holy Family Hospital that babies take their first breath, see the world for the first time, and meet the ones who love them the most, their parents. But what's really special about this hospital is where it's located. Because it was here, on this land, that something incredible happened 2,000 years ago. Today, close to the very spot where Jesus was born, this hospital, run by the Order of Malta, wants to make sure the babies born in Bethlehem today have the best love and care possible.
Always we have joy here, new babies, a new life. We are with the woman in her pain, then in her joy. We see the first moment of life.
And that is the goal of everyone working here at the hospital, bringing new life into the world. Michelle Beau is the Order of Malta's ambassador to Palestine.
And last year, I believe, you delivered over 4,500 babies?
Yeah, I think it was 4,646 babies born here in Bethlehem. Just beautiful, bright lights of hope for the mothers and fathers of the Hebron and Bethlehem region. We serve a catchment area of about 1 million people. and we're the only hospital that can deliver and care for babies born before 34 weeks.
The hospital specializes in neonatal care for premature babies.
In our department, we have the total beds between 18 or 20 sometimes. Some babies are cardiac, we have cardiac problem and surgical problem.
This is Ishraf Faraj, the nurse in charge of the ward.
The baby 39 weeks with 3 kilo and needs ventilator and other things for the intensive care.
This little baby is going to be just fine. But sadly, as is the tragic reality of life, for other families, the news is more heartbreaking. And just across the ward, laying in another bed, is a little baby who is not going to make it.
So this baby, unfortunately, he has a congenital bone disease. He was born with multiple fractures, and unfortunately, there's no treatment. This baby is dying. But we're trying to make his life as comfortable as we can. This is the most horrible situation you can be faced with.
For many of the mothers who have extremely sick babies that require extensive, complex, and expensive care, they come from poverty and can't afford the treatment. Some even live here in the Desha community, the largest refugee community in Bethlehem.
This is a Palestinian refugee camp here in Bethlehem. It's one of three, actually. Hello. And this is where many of the mothers go to the hospital in Bethlehem to give birth.
The hospital has become famous in Palestine as the Order of Malta covers the costs and provides the best care, regardless of how much or how little the patient can afford.
This is a hospital that's doors are wide open to all without regard to need or creed. We don't just take care of a baby that was born 26 weeks gestation and keep them in the hospital for 5 months and then send them home to a home without electricity. We care for them, we keep them a little extra so they can get a little bit chubby, and then we send them home with cards for electricity so the baby can have a warm place, particularly in the winter because Bethlehem is cold. It's a high desert and it's cold in the winter.
For those who can't come to the hospital will come to them. And every week, a mobile health clinic leaves Bethlehem and travels into the rural desert land. It's here, in the communities of the indigenous Bedouin people, that the mothers, many of them quite young, can avail of services that they would otherwise never be able to get.
This is the mobile clinic, the clinic inside the car. There is a resident doctor with ultrasound to check the mummies, and there is generator for electricity.
The men of this community make it very clear to us that we are not to film their wives, and the ones who are there without their husbands refuse to speak to us on camera. But inside the specially fitted van, the nurse tells us about the services available.
We give them a primary care as ultrasound investigation.
Close by, school children watch on. They will be the future of these communities and most likely will be availing of the service as well. Back in the hospital, and a young student nurse has just delivered a beautiful baby girl.
Yes, I delivered this baby with the help of, from my teacher, Nargis.
No fears,
yes.
No fears.
Because I'm behind her.
Yes.
I'm supporting her. She's my student.
The hospital puts a strong emphasis on training and hiring student doctors and nurses. And 71% of their employees are women.
This is an ecumenical hospital. It's an ecumenical workplace where Christians and Muslims work together.
All working in harmony.
Working in harmony. Everybody wears the cross of the order on their arm.
I'm a Christian and she's a Muslim. We respect each other. We work together in operating room as a team, as a friend, as sisters. It's the best hospital in Palestine.
I feel like we're making an actual difference here in Palestine. And what we really do is we bring them hope. We restore the dignity to women so that they can work or take care of grandchildren. The Blessed Mother delivered her baby among the animals, and we're promising today that that will never happen to another mother in Bethlehem.
Every delivery is magical, because
it's a unique
time or unique seconds for the lady.
All healthy, happy?
Yes.
Wow.
Pink color.
Pink color.
Moving, responding.
Regardless of the incredible challenges facing the patients who come here and the staff who work here, the Holy Family Hospital continues to be that beacon of light for the mothers of Bethlehem and their newborn babies, 2,000 years after the birth of Jesus on this very land. In Bethlehem, Cullum Flynn, EWTN News in Depth.
It's always great to see new life, especially in Bethlehem. And as we celebrate Advent and the birth of Jesus, another special report for you next week. Cullum travels to the mountains of northern Italy, home to renowned woodworkers who make some of the world's most beloved nativity scenes. Their work is featured in the Vatican's Christmas decorations. The artisans who help beautify our Advent next week on EWTN News in Depth.
You need to have God in the conversation. And we decided to take a look at art from the perspective of God being there, the image of beauty that he places in our soul.
Enjoying art through a new lens, my conversation with the author of Pilgrimage to the Museum, Man's Search for God Through Art and Time, when we return.
Christmas mark the beginning of the new liturgical year, and the Church encourages Catholics to enrich their faith in new ways. Stephen Auth, a veteran investor on Wall Street, deepened his faith through art and now helps other Catholics discover God with a special tour through the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York. This year, he published a book called Pilgrimage to the Museum, Man's Search for God Through Art and Time, which allows readers to take this spiritual journey through the Met from the comfort of their own homes. I recently spoke to Steve about his new book, his faith, and his love of art. Steve, it's so great to have you here to discuss this wonderful book. I dove into it and I couldn't put it down. Pilgrimage to the Museum.
Thank you. Thank you, Monza.
Let's get started just about your personal journey coming back into the Church. A lot of people see these books and they think this person must be, you know, a zealot, you know, really into the Church all of his life and well-formed.
Yeah, I think one of the things that makes the book attractive to people is it's written by a broken vessel, you know. I grew up as an altar boy, very Catholic family, but by the time I got finished with college at Princeton, I was, at best, an indifferent agnostic. And my journey to the faith started to come back slowly through marrying my beautiful bride, who is a devout Catholic. The kids get raised. But about 25 years ago, I had a near-death experience, and a priest came up to give me last rites and my first confession in 25 years. And when we got done with that, he said, Steve, you know, you're a guy with a lot of talents, and your big problem right now is that you've been using them for yourself and not for God.
Wow.
And I resolved, if I survived, I was going to turn my talents and use them for God. And that led to our mission work on the streets of New York, which a lot of folks know about now. And this second mission, because I had, you know, a lot of background in art history. And we love taking people through the Met. So we just started doing that years ago. But at some point, and it's described at the very beginning, the missionary of the Pilgrimage to the Museum, there's this point where I have this epiphany that looking at art through the lens of purely classical art historians, which kind of sanitize and make it scientific, and it's kind of sanitized the paintings, is a good place to start, but you need to have God in the conversation. And we decided to take a look at art from the perspective of God being there the image of beauty that he places in our soul, the image of himself. And we just redid the entire tour, and it became a pilgrimage, starting from ancient Egypt right up through the moderns.
It's interesting that you chose art that isn't necessarily religious. That's something that some people have commented about, the reality of, well, if you want to talk about religion and art, there's a lot of religious art we can talk about.
Yeah.
Why choose things that aren't codified as religious?
I think maybe partly sort of coming from my own background and realizing that we're all seeking God even when we don't realize we're seeking God. And I always ask the pilgrims at the start of the tour, if you could just work with me on this. And I quote from Ecclesiastes how, you know, I've placed the timeless into their hearts such that they'll never know the works that I have done. And just work with me on this. And at first they're a little suspicious, but as you start to go through and you see, my goodness, they were seeking God. And then you start to see these themes occur and recur over thousands of years with different artists in different periods of time and different styles of working art. You begin to say, wait a second here, there's something greater at work. You know, in some ways, the conclusion of the whole exercise for me is when, you know, written up in the epilogue, and I ask myself, is this man seeking God, or is it God seeking us in some ways, right, through art?
Do you think that there is one nugget, one story, one reaction that you've had from these tours that really kind of stands out for you, whether it's about history or maybe a faith journey or someone who saw something or reacted in a way you just didn't expect?
Well, you know, almost every night when we go, we unpack the tour over dinner. And we have little prayer cards. We go around and ask people their favorite painting. And what's remarkable to me is how so many different paintings get chosen. And so some people are touched in a way you wouldn't have thought, you know. And they often will be crying, actually, over dinner because of the impact on them. But everyone's impacted differently. There's a broad variety of art in the pilgrimage. And people always find their favorite one, you know, in the storyline.
I found a favorite one in the pilgrimage through the book. I can't wait to go to the museum at some point and really live it. But for me, it was the journey that we take with Bathsheba, where you talk about the relationship between the artist and God and where he was in his faith journey and how that context is almost so much more important than anything else.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit more about that.
Yeah, I think The Toilet of Bathsheba is a painting you're referencing, Monse, and, you know, actually the book starts there because that's where I had this sort of epiphany. And in some ways, you know, an art historian will tell you, well, this is a painting from Rembrandt's Oriental period. He was very interested in things of the Far East. It's one of his only nudes, and this is this beautiful image of Bathsheba. And as I'm standing there looking at it, listening to the docent, I'm thinking, well, everything she's saying is absolutely accurate. And in ways, absolutely wrong, because it's not a painting about Bathsheba at all. It's a painting about David. And in some ways, it's a painting about Rembrandt himself. And in a deeper level, it's a painting about each of us, right? Mm-hmm. It's about the slippery slope of sin. And you see this image of Bathsheba with darkness all around her, and the light is shining on her, right? So that's sort of, you know, the devil has a way of focusing us on the wrong thing, if you will. And what we're looking at in that image is not actually Bathsheba. It's the image of Bathsheba.
Yeah.
In Rembrandt's mind, or let's say in David's mind, as he up in the dark tower up there, looks on and begins to imagine, you know, what a night with her might be like. And it's, you know, it's what a priest friend of mine always says, you know, Steve, the first look's not your fault.
The second look
is your fault. And this is like the third look. And, well, then, you know, it's the beginning of the slippery slope for David, right? He invites her over. They have an affair. Then she gets pregnant. They've committed adultery. He tries to cover it up. It's the slippery slope of sin. Rembrandt at that time is himself having an affair with his housekeeper. And there's this garter on Bathsheba's calf, garter mark, which the art historians at the time, or the community at the time, and art historians later always like talk about, like, what was he doing with this garter? I always felt it was Rembrandt's way of saying, that's my housekeeper there.
It's about me.
This is a modern woman. This is not Bathsheba at all. And I think I think of the Toilet of Bathsheba as Rembrandt's Psalm 51. David famously writes Psalm 51. It's one of the great penitential psalms that's often been given to me as a penance.
Create a clean heart, yeah.
Yeah, and it's a great penitential psalm, but in a way, I think the painting of it becomes Rembrandt's Psalm 51.
That's beautiful. That's a beautiful reflection. And do you think that part of the inspiration for this is the fact that the church has used beauty as a reflection of truth in the past, and there's a tradition of it within the church?
I always felt like the churches were built to show the miracle of the Mass, right? I mean, it's heaven on earth inside mm-hmm. of a church. This is where God comes to us through the Eucharist. And all the beauty of the church, of the churches and the paintings were designed to help us understand that this is God, this is God's beauty. I mean, the Renaissance painters were trying to paint things through the eyes of God. That's why they're so beautiful and so perfect.
That's beautiful. Thank you so much. I hope that everyone will not only read this, but figure out how to get on this tour with you.
Thank you, Monse.
You can hear my full conversation with Stephen Auth on our social media. Find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at EWTN News In Depth. Top headlines are next in the Week in Review. New protections for same-sex marriage from lawmakers on Capitol Hill. What does that mean for religious liberty? American bishops condemn anti-Semitism. And the war in Ukraine takes its place amid the pomp and circumstance of the French president's state visit to the White House. We'll be right back. News from the Senate and passage there of the Respect for Marriage Act tops the Week in Review. The bill enshrines protections for same-sex unions. It was supported by the Democratic caucus and 12 Republicans. The bill would require all states to recognize and accept the legitimacy of those unions performed in states where same-sex marriage is legal. Critics say it provides limited protections for those who believe in traditional marriage, including churches and other faith-based organizations. That, they say, is a threat to religious liberty.
The passage for Respect for Marriage, giving millions of Americans equal justice under the law, peace of mind, knowing their right to marry the person they love is protected.
It certainly doesn't subject religious organizations or faith-based institutions or even private citizens to lawsuits for exercising their deeply held religious objections to same-sex marriage.
The bill now returns to the House for a final vote before it reaches the president's desk. Herbie Newell, president of Lifeline Children's Services, joins us now to provide perspective on the impact this act could have on people of faith. Herbie, thanks for being with us. Lifeline Children's serves foster and adoptive parents of faith. What challenges does this bill present for your community?
Yeah, certainly. I think whenever we look at marriage, especially, we understand historically that marriage in the United States is for the protection of children. It's for the flourishing and protection of children. It was never for the whims or the desires of the two married people. And so I think especially when you look at the closely held Christian belief of marriage, so many of the families that we serve are serving in foster care communities. They're serving in adoption communities. And we don't want these families to have to go through extra hurdles or hoops because they hold to a traditional view of marriage. And so even what we've seen since Obergefell is many of our states are taking a very stereotypical view towards Christian families who have such a strong, closely held belief of marriage, and they're even not giving placements to those families. They are making those families sign documents and agree to things that they don't agree with in order to participate in foster care and adoption. And when in our country especially, over 60% of the children in foster care are being fostered by Christian families, I don't think we want to eliminate Christian families from this very important service that they're providing around our nation.
and that they're such a big part of. Some say that the legal protections for religious freedom are still the same because there's been no change to existing court cases and the Constitution. But putting that to the side, if they currently protect religious freedom, but the culture doesn't define it in that way, does that provide a big problem for you still?
Oh, for sure. And, you know, let's even talk about adding, you know, extra RFRA measures to this case. I think when you really look at it on the surface, the reason we have a Supreme Court is for a court of justices to look at the Constitution, to look at laws that have been passed, and determine if in that situation what needs to be done. This doesn't mean that there won't be litigiousness brought, cases brought against faith-based organizations. It doesn't stop faith-based organizations having to continually fight suits. It doesn't mean that they won't continually have to fight this. Maybe there's some protection once it gets to the Supreme Court. But even with that, Monsi, I mean, most nonprofit organizations, most faith-based organizations don't have the mechanisms, the bandwidth, nor the funding to be able to defend themselves all the way to the Supreme Court. I think that second of all, we are continuing to alienate the traditional view that marriage is between a man and a woman, which makes it increasingly hard, to the second part of your question, for faith-based organizations to continue not only to operate, but to thrive in this culture, because those traditional values that were the basis and the fabric of our nation that brought us to flourishing are now seen as antiquated and even as judgmental and non-tolerant. And so when you start to redefine even in culture what's right and what's wrong by calling everything that Western civilization and civilization since the beginning has been based upon and now calling that antiquated and wrong, socially, it puts Christian families, it puts Christian ministries in an untenable place in our society.
You're tipping the scales against them. So then what should people of faith do in these circumstances? What is your call to action to your community?
Yeah, well, first and foremost, I would hope that people of faith, Christians, Catholics, evangelicals, I pray that we would not compromise. I don't think this is a time that we need to be fearful of calling marriage what it is, designed by God for one man, one woman for a lifetime. And I think we need to make sure that we hold true to that and that we don't allow the culture to change our closely held beliefs. I don't think capitulating to culture is what we need to do, but I think we need to really do what we saw Jesus Christ do in his earthly ministry, which was love, but love with truth. And so we need to speak truth, but we need to speak it in love. And we need to continue to be able to help. We need to continue to do the things that we're doing. And we have to also remember that we were never promised a primrose path. We were never promised that things would be easy, but we need to continue to do good. We need to continue to do the things we've been called to do. And even when difficult, we need to make sure we stand up for our values. We need to make sure we stand up for who we are, and we don't need to compromise. And I think if more people would not shrink back, but would go forward, continuing to do ministry, to continue to show love and mercy and grace, but not to compromise, I think when we unfortunately do see these cases and we do see things come to the Supreme Court, ultimately, I do think that these values will be appreciated and will be defended.
Well, it's an important stake that you're and a line that you're drawing here. Thank you so much, Herbie.
Thanks for having me. And certainly let's pray for our great nation.
Amen. The United States Conference of Catholic Bishops is condemning the recent increase of anti-Semitic attacks. In a statement earlier this week, the bishops encouraged all Catholics to oppose anti-Semitism in all forms and emphasize the shared heritage of Christianity and Judaism. The bishops released the documents on the 60th anniversary of Nostra Aetate, Pope St. Paul VI's encyclical that began a new era of understanding and cooperation between the two faiths. The USCCB's Committee on Ecumenical and Interreligious Affairs says it is outraged by the deeply hurtful proliferations of anti-Semitic rhetoric, both online and in person, and the violent attacks on Jewish individuals, homes, and institutions. We wish to convey our sincere support to the Jewish people. As Pope Francis stated, a true Christian cannot be an anti-Semite. The months ahead will be difficult in Ukraine as winter approaches and temperatures routinely dip below zero. Russia continues its attack on the power grid, prompting more people to evacuate. On Thursday, Russian shelling cut off power in the recently liberated Ukrainian city of Kherson, causing many locals to flee the area for safety. The shelling has been especially intense there since Russian forces withdrew and Ukraine's army reclaimed the southern city. Here's retired General Wesley Clark, former Supreme Allied Commander of NATO, on the Russian shelling campaign.
We know that they're drawing down their inventories. We know they can't produce the most modern missiles, but they've got old stuff that can be thrown at the Ukrainians. They're apparently now taking nuclear warheads off some of their missiles and just lobbing them in there, either as decoys or letting the metal speak for itself when it hits the ground. So they're going to keep this up for as long as they can. This is the Russian strategy. They can't win on the battlefield. Maybe they can pummel the Ukrainian people into demanding a ceasefire.
Ukrainian utility workers are working to restore power to the grid, but it's a never-ending task. As some power comes back on, restoring electricity and heat, other areas are knocked out. The Ukrainian Greek Catholic Church is issuing an appeal to international authorities to help facilitate the release of two Ukrainian priests captured by Russian troops. They have been held in captivity for more than 2 weeks and are reportedly being tortured. The priests had chosen to stay in territory under Russian occupation to minister to Catholic communities there. The Russians are accusing the priests of subversive and guerrilla activities. The Ukraine war dominated talks between President Joe Biden and French President Emmanuel Macron this week during Macron's state visit to Washington. In meetings at the White House, they presented a united front in addressing the response to the war in Ukraine. The two leaders also discussed concerns about China's increasing assertiveness in the Indo-Pacific and the Biden administration's climate change law. Macron wants better coordination between the two nations' climate actions, but they agreed the top of the agenda was the war in Ukraine, as the U.S. and France work together to keep economic and military aid flowing to Kyiv.
And we'll continue the strong support to the people of Ukraine as they defend their homes and their families and their sovereignty and territorial integrity against Russian aggression, which has been incredibly brutal. I knew Russia was, but I didn't anticipate them being as brutal as they have been and what they've been doing.
The first couple then hosted President Macron and his wife Brigitte at the Biden administration's first state dinner. It's the most formal occasion for any White House and is the first for the Bidens because of prior COVID restrictions. The evening was capped by a toast between the two presidents, pledging friendship and unity between the United States and France, which is America's oldest ally. A marvel of nature sprang to life this week in Hawaii, showing our Earth is ever amazing. Mauna Loa, the world's largest active volcano, is erupting for the first time in nearly four decades. These incredible pictures show lava spewing from the volcano and flowing down. Hawaii locals flock to the eruption site to catch a look. While the active volcano is currently more of an attraction than a threat, scientists believe the lava flow could reach roads within days. Volcanic smog could also spread across the island and even reach the rest of Hawaii. State health officials are encouraging people to cut back on outdoor activities. Scientists expect the eruption to last a few weeks.
I've said, Jesus, I trust in you more in this last 4 years than I've ever said in my entire life, and God has not failed us.
One man's faith journey. We follow a Navy veteran's path from non-believer to founder of a new Catholic school that's getting rave reviews. We have his story and a look inside the school when we return.
A belief in the value of classical liberal education, plus a conversion to Catholicism, led one U.S. Navy veteran on a mission. It's not every day that a former atheist opens a brand new Catholic school, but this man's faith led him to it. Mark Irons has this faith journey and death story.
A new mission launched.
Our schools have gotten away from putting God at the center.
From soaring airways to school hallways, a civilian now, his Catholic faith at the heart of this mission. Not long ago, retired Lieutenant Commander Ali Ghaffari served the U.S. as a Navy fighter pilot.
I was able to fly in Afghanistan and Iraq, and I loved my time in the Navy.
Amen. In the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit.
You went from having a successful career as a Navy fighter pilot to now starting a Catholic school. Why?
Great question. Love of my kids at the heart of it. I want my kids to become saints. I want them to be in heaven one day.
Ghaffari believes that goal begins with education. And for this former atheist, his own conversion to Catholicism was sparked by learning, focused on seeking truth.
The ancient Greeks were critical to my coming to faith and understanding that truth exists and it's not all relative.
Exposure to ancient Greek philosophy as a young adult led him to learn more about the lives of great Catholic saints, including Aquinas and Augustine, saints formed in the classical liberal arts. A vision for education with roots in ancient Greece, adopted by the Catholic Church for nearly 2,000 years, but hard to find in many schools today. Ghaffari wanted it for his own children, so he started his own school.
You don't have a background in education or administration. This is sort of a dream and a vision you had, and you did it.
It's just setting a vision and having an idea of what you want to do, and that vision then attracts people and then putting them in the right spot. So I would say anybody can do this.
In Pasadena, Maryland, he showed us around Divine Mercy Academy, the independent Catholic school he started 3 years ago. It isn't run by a diocese, but the school's Catholic identity is clear.
The mission, number one, is to make saints, and the number two is to make scholars.
To operate the school, he's found the right faculty, practicing Catholics trained in the classical approach, on fire for sharing the faith. 110 students here, grades K through 8, are formed using the classical liberal arts model of education. The word liberal meaning to be free. The ancient Greeks believed it was education for a free person, giving them the ability to think freely, to search for truth, and grow in virtue.
And so a classical liberal education is an education that focuses on the bigger questions. You know, why are we here? And what should I do with my life?
Students at Divine Mercy Academy are encouraged to ask those bigger questions. More than studying solely for what's on a test, Ghaffari says they are learning to think critically, analyze, and apply those skills to a broad range of subjects.
To understand history, to understand art, to understand science in the roots and how it integrates fully with each other and with faith.
And faith keeps the whole mission grounded. God is at the center.
It begins with him, right? And then it's his creation. And the classical model is based on curiosity and invitation. So what do you notice here? What do you observe? Why do you think that might be? How does that connect to this, that, and the other thing?
Ghaffari believes Catholic education faces a widespread problem today, a loss of Catholic identity. Too many Catholic schools trying to model themselves after public schools.
I think that's an error because they miss the most important thing, which is God. And so as a result, we've compromised our faith, and our faith has become minimized and sidelined in favor of the latest new trend in education.
He says classical liberal arts education is far from the newest trend.
We're just bringing back what was so successful for 2,000 years.
Prayer is a critical part of each day at Divine Mercy Academy. Ghaffari says one family found the school to be too Catholic. They removed their child from the school when they learned religion was practiced in more than one class.
We're going to be attending Mass daily. We're going to be praying the Rosary daily. We're going to be praying the Divine Mercy Chapel daily. Either they get really excited about that or they say, I don't think this is quite the place for me.
But a glowing endorsement came last year when Bishop Thomas Daly from the Diocese of Spokane, Washington visited. A high authority, Bishop Daly is the head of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops Committee on Catholic Education.
What did he say?
That we're the future of Catholic education.
Ghaffari believes Bishop Daly saw something unique.
Children excited about their faith. Children practicing their faith with joy.
And it's hard to ignore where classes for Divine Mercy Academy take place. Inside a former diocesan Catholic school. The sign is still out front. Markings throughout the building. For over half a century, this was home to St. Jane Francis School. But it was plagued by continual declining enrollment, and a couple of years ago, the Archdiocese of Baltimore had to shut it down. Divine Mercy Academy now rents the building, and enrollment in the independent school has increased since its founding, doubling each of its first 3 years.
There's obviously a difference there in what's made this successful. What is it?
It's fidelity to the faith, putting God first in everything. And then I think the classical model, having that as an additional element there, is also very attractive to families.
A former career and conversion to Catholicism took him to new heights. But Ali Ghaffari wants to help others on the path to heaven, and this mission is expanding. He hopes for a new school building to house Divine Mercy Academy, the creation of more academies across the country, and ultimately, a return to classical liberal arts education in all schools.
And I think the only way back to a lively and vibrant church is through education. It begins with our kids.
Mark Irons, EWTN News in depth.
On our own faith journeys, how many of us start a brand new school? Impressive. Best of luck to Divine Mercy Academy. Another educational opportunity for children learning about the faith. A few months ago, we took you to a book reading at Our Lady Queen of Angels Catholic School in New York City. Mother Claire Matthias of the Franciscan Sisters of the Renewal has written The Little Convent in the Big City children's book series to introduce the life of women religious to children. The series features fictional character Sister Mary Andy and her lovable convent of nuns. These students loved hearing the first book called The Unsolved Problem. Now the second book in the series has been released. The Light in You follows Sister Mary Andy as she persuades a lonely neighbor to attend midnight mass. What happens next is a Christmas miracle. You can find out more about the Little Convent in the Big City book series at vianivocations.com. And that does it for this edition of EWTN News in Depth. We continue our observance of the Advent season next week with a report from Northern Italy, where so many nativity scenes are handcrafted. I'm Montse Alvarado. We hope to see you same time next week for more reports important to your Catholic life here on EWTN.